The longest distance we will ever travel is from our head to our heart, and I'm here to help you shorten the journey. Welcome to the Perfection Detox Podcast. I'm your host, Petra Kolber. This is the place to come when you need help dialing down the negative, turning up the positive, and dropping the weight of perfectionism, self-doubt, and fear so that you can soar into a life of your dreams. For show notes from this episode, please go to petrakolber.com/podcast. Okay, let's dive in. Today's guest is an executive coach who works with senior executives and high potential leaders to help them create positive, permanent shifts in the leadership impact and the results they achieve, Alyssa Cohen. A CPA, Alyssa earned her MBA from Cornell University, where she was awarded the Freed Fellowship for Leadership and Academic Excellence. Alyssa is known for her high energy and enthusiasm, along with her practical, results-oriented approach. She was selected as one of the top 10 coaches by Women's Business, who called her absolutely brilliant and a superhero, and was just named as one of the top leadership speakers of 2018 by Inc. magazine. Alyssa is a member of the Cornell Entrepreneurship Advisory Board. She's on the faculty of the Runway Program at Cornell Tech, an accelerator which focuses on helping postdocs commercialize their research and build companies. Please welcome today's guest, Alyssa Cohen.
Hi, Petra.
I'm so excited to have you. We're sitting here in your beautiful home.
Thank you.
And when I have met the guest before, I tried to kind of go over when I first remember meeting the guest, yeah. And it was with you, Christmas Day.
Yes, two years ago with
yeah. Joy Clark and my sister Jenny.
Yes, we had the best time.
We went to the movies and we had dinner.
Yeah.
Loved meeting you on Christmas.
You were like honorary Jews.
Now, fast forward 2 years, a lot has happened.
Yeah.
And I want to give a little bit of background to the audience who might not know you. And I think you have this, and I reached out this afternoon on Facebook, and people have so many questions about leadership, either leading themselves or leading others. And you have so much experience with that. You have a lot of interest in startups, mm-hmm. which I would imagine is a very scary and brave terrain to go into, because there's a lot of fear and unknown in startups.
Yeah.
To also executive coaching, what is it about the startup industry that fascinates you?
Oh, well, you know, the founders that I work with, it's like they are peering off into the distance over your shoulder, looking at something that you don't see. And I think that's extraordinary and such a gift. They have such drive, such passion, such grit, such pluck. And it's also just very exciting. It's exciting to look at and to understand different businesses as they grow. And most importantly for me as a coach, what does it take to move from two people in the garage, like I would say like two guys in a beer can, like the two people in the garage with the dog, moving from there to a real company with 8 people and then 20 people and 50 people and 100 people, what does it take for a CEO and founder to lead that company? Very different things at every stage. And I just think it's endlessly interesting. Also, you know, when I think about the ups and downs of startups, I can add so much value as a coach because it's like real and it's raw and it's happening right now.
Do you allow them to kind of work through their pain points from like a non-emotional perspective? Is that when they would bring you in, Alyssa? I mean, I can imagine the emotions must be running so high.
Oh, yeah. Well, when you say not, they work through their issues and sort of what's going on with them in a very emotional way. And part of, I think, the value of me as a coach is I can handle their emotions and also help them get it out and then think about how do I reframe? How do I take productive action? How do I choose a response rather than having a reaction? Which is something we all have to learn, but in the fast-paced world of startups and the ups and downs and turbulence of startups, that really is very relevant. I think there's that, but also when I'm brought in various times, because the other thing about founders is that, you know, they're certainly often first-time founders and first-time CEOs, but sometimes they're first-time leaders. Right, that they haven't even had any leadership experience or management experience, not really, not significantly, certainly not in growing a company. So part of it is talk about their inner journey and give them the safe space to talk about that. And part of it is just the tactics around how do you run a business and set up an executive team and give people feedback and do performance review. So I've been in the startup game and I've been working almost exclusively with startups for like 10 years, not almost exclusively, but like I've been working primarily with startups for about 10 years. And before that, I was a CFO of a startup and the head of strategy of a different startup. So I definitely understand the way startups are structured, and I've kind of seen that movie before. I think they find all that valuable.
That whole idea of some, like you had mentioned, some people have never been a leader before.
Yeah.
And I see this a lot in every industry, the fitness industry that was my beachhead for like 30 years, where someone gets promoted, but no one teaches you.
It's so true.
Have you seen a common flaw that we often in leadership when for a first-time leader or someone moving into a position, or a common weakness? I hate to say weakness, but something that you kind of hone in on immediately to strengthen. Is there something, is that running thread, or is it always a completely different situation from company to company?
And from person to person, yeah. Right? I think that the common thread is that when you're the CEO, you're under surveillance. You're on display. Everybody is watching you. So the CEOs I work with simply aren't used to that. They have not been exposed to greater and greater levels of scrutiny like we would normally growing up in corporate America. Suddenly, they're just on stage, and they don't realize how much their words and deeds and even the expression on their face impacts other people. So that's one common topic, very common theme that people really have to learn sometimes the hard way, that everyone's watching them. The second common theme sounds opposite. And what it is that they don't realize that people are not listening to them until they repeat themselves over and over and over again. So CEOs and all leaders have to communicate, over-communicate time and time again to get everyone on the same page. And it's easy for everybody then to scatter and get off the same page. So CEOs have to bring them back onto the same page. So those two are very common elements that CEOs really have to learn, so, you know, painfully at times.
That whole thing you said about being seen and on a stage.
Yeah.
I kind of relate that back to many of the listeners might not be CEOs, but they want to start, you know, leading themselves, taking new risks.
Oh, yeah.
Growing, expanding. And I kind of compare that to social media.
Oh, that's right. That's very interesting. Yeah.
And I think a lot of people, Alyssa, get stuck of not going for that next step because of this fear of failing in public. Because when I grew up and I was teaching fitness, and you know, it's very different now to me now being a speaker and a writer as I'm growing and learning.
Yeah.
I'm also, there's people in the audience, you know, tweeting, hopefully I had the learning time to learn and fail again in private.
Right.
And you don't get that luxury anymore.
Right, right. When you say private, it's just a smaller audience, no matter what, because they don't have the reach that we now have with Twitter and with social media. And even with podcasts, right? So it's absolutely true. And I think if I think about people leading themselves, you know, what's important to note is that taking risks is essential and it's mandatory. It's not optional. And that people have to realize that there are many detours and no shortcuts in getting where you want to get. And really, but just like a CEO has set a vision for a startup and set a vision for his or her company, you have to set a vision for you, for your life, to really figure out where am I going to go, and then step by step with persistence and the ups and downs of trying and failing and trying and failing, that's how anyone gets anywhere.
I love that you said there are no detours and no shortcuts.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, and there's a great question here actually from someone that had written in and said, it sounds like a simple question, but do you know, is there an underlying, I think everyone's why is different, but Jamie had asked, you were talking about the direction of their life and the profession. In these detours, how do we stay true to ourselves while, you know, how do we stay resilient as we have to go through these detours and the ups and downs? Have you seen a common thread, or what do you teach as a coach to help people weather, you know, enjoy the sweet moments while they're there.
Right.
And then know that the not so great moments, you're either going to work a way around it, through it, but you're going to become stronger on the other side. Is there something that you teach people, Alyssa, or a strategy that you help them remember when it's not so good?
Well, so just to say, the strategy is around purpose and really having your purpose and having your bigger picture. And again, that can be personal, and that can be for the sake of the company. I will share a personal story. When I became a coach, I became a coach 16 years ago. And so it's like on Friday, you say, I'm going to become a coach. So then I always say this to people, what do you do on Monday? What do you think? And people have these different ideas. What did I do on Monday, the day I decided to become a coach? I made a collage of my ideal life and my ideal work life. And I must tell you, it was super helpful. Like, I cut all these little papers, these little pictures out of a magazine, and I put them on this collage, and I saw, this is the life I imagined. Now, 8 months later, I remember vividly, I was in Boston at the time. It was like a snowstorm hailing. I was going to this like vendor fair or something at my gym, and you know, in order to get clients and to network, and I thought I'd be able to, you know, make a splash there. And it was rain. It was like rain, sleeting rain, and I had to go to the FedEx store to make the photocopies of this flyer, and I was miserable. And I thought, it's not about the photocopies, and it's not about the sleeting rain. It is about me living that life. And I really saw my collage as like a beacon for how do you get through the difficult moments and the setbacks. And that's a personal journey. Professionally, right, when you're leading a company, you need to think about the people that you're leading, the sort of fulfillment of the idea that you're trying to promulgate. You know, it's true, the startups that I work with, they're literally attempting something that's never been done before. There's a lot of setback in that journey, people who don't believe and it doesn't work and you have to keep trying. Knowing that you're doing something that's going to be significant and valuable and have a legacy, that is where the juice is. Or that you're responsible for 8 people, 20 people, 100 people, 500 people, you know, and recognizing that as a community, really as a tribe, they're moving forward together and that you're responsible for these people and helping them self-actualize in the workplace. All those things give purpose.
I think it's so important, Liz, that you share that story in your first few months as a coach. You're going to a vendor fair at a gym, doing your photocopies, probably, you know, on your own dime, not knowing, because this, and I think this is a, not to bring social media up again, but to bring it up again, people see you now like, well, she's, you know, she was just named one of the top leadership speakers. And but we forget the 10,000, 100,000 hours of what it takes to, and I say, you know, then we go back and there's this idea of this vision board, which you kind of had, but then you put action behind
it. You have to put out. By the way, I still have the vision board.
Right? And just to be clear. Are you living the dream?
I'm living the dream. I really am. And there was a lot around there about tenacity. You know, there's one quote about a fashion designer said, the students of mine who are most successful are not the most creative. They are the most persistent. And that's where, you know, I know that I have persistence and I have drive. And when people compliment me on my accomplishments, I appreciate it. But what I know, what I say to them right back, it didn't just happen. You know, I really put one foot in front of the other and continue to do so. Because, you know, being named one of the top speakers by Inc. was a huge deal. And don't forget, I write now for Forbes. I write for Worth. I've just started to write for Inc. magazine as a result of this, you know, new sort of, I don't know, radar screen. And, I would say 3 years ago, I wasn't writing for anybody, right? I'm writing for startup publications now. But why? Because it's like hard to figure out how to get on the radar screen. It's because you've got to have persistence. It's because you've got to ask. You've got to be willing to ask and be rejected. And you learn to do that over time in your skin. And you know this, your skin gets tougher over time.
Yeah. I think that's so valuable. And with that, I want to actually, when you talk about like, there's a lot of like rejection and you know, success and failure when they're starting up.
Yeah.
Mindy had written in, how do you know when it's time to let go and move on? Outside of you run out of money.
I know.
And this could be both personal and in business. You know, it's like we want to give it our all. And someone had said, hire slow and fire fast.
Fire fast, yeah.
You know, I mean, but how do we know when you're so emotionally attached to something? I mean, I don't know if there's an absolute answer, but do you have any guidance on that?
You know, it's a good question because the startups I work with, there have been very challenging on the brink times. And a lot of them, I would say the majority of them, have one way or the other pulled out more than one miracle. And really it's about finding what you need to do to keep going. Actually, like to me, that's a keep going question, as in, how do you manage your finances, again, personally or at a company, so that you have the wherewithal to keep going? How do you get more market feedback to tweak and to fine tune what you're doing enough to keep going and get new traction elsewhere? And finding the signals of traction. But I would say, how do you know when to quit? If you're really not getting any traction and you adjust and are getting no traction, and something inside of you is just sort of realizing that you're just going down the wrong path, I think that's a good moment to re-examine. And also, it's helpful to have an advisory board. If you speak personally, when you have an advisory board around you, those people can cheer you on and cheer you on. And they can also tell you the hard truth, which is it's time to think of that something else to do.
I think that's really important, to surround yourself with people
Yes. Who
will have your back.
Oh, yeah.
But will also tell you it's time.
Yeah. Loving critics.
I like that.
Yeah.
Loving critics. We get very focused on the critics and the naysayers.
Right.
But sometimes being told the truth is one of the sweetest things a friend or an advisor
so
can do.
So true. And then when it comes from love, that's the point. When you have trusted people who are really on your side, they can tell you what there is to tell you and you can hear it.
Now, you were talking about a lot of it is, you know, having the wherewithal to keep going.
Yes.
So that you see the miracles. Because Yes. That miracle might be just around the corner.
It's so true.
Which really
yeah,
is like,
I know. It's so it's so tantalizing from that point of view.
Yeah. Someone had actually written here, and I think this could be said to us for ourselves too. John had written in, how do you help motivate your team when they are doing their jobs with no enthusiasm?
Mm.
And I think that could also be, how do we stay motivated
yeah.
on the days we don't always wake up and jump out of bed.
Hardly.
That's right. Know, so do yeah. you have any, you know, guidelines that you as a coach
yes.
give companies?
Yes. Let's start with companies. First of all, how do you motivate your employees? Hire self-motivated people. Have them set loose themselves, right? So who are you hiring that are doing their jobs with no enthusiasm? That's number one. Then the second question is, what conversations have you had with them? Have you taken them out for lunch? Have you taken them out to find out what is your career aspirations? Where are you coming from? What brings you joy? What fires up your purpose? Have you had values conversations with them? Not like, oh, what are your values? But really like, well, what do you love to do? And what do you love about your job? And what do you hate about your job? And in that sort of discussion and in that sort of puzzle, there's probably one or two elements that help people understand, what am I on fire about? Then I would add, how are you creating psychological safety for people? Because if people feel like they're just, you know, sort of getting beaten up or somehow not doing it good enough, it's not good enough, they don't have confidence, they don't feel safe, and then they shut down.
Can I interrupt here?
Of course.
You're the first person I've ever heard use the word psychological safety. I think that's so important.
Yeah.
How does someone go about creating that? Is it in your actions, your words, your demeanor, leading from a place of authenticity and vulnerability versus fear-based leadership?
Certainly, certainly not fear-based leadership. And I wouldn't even say it's authenticity, which I think is an overused word.
I do,
right?
Too.
I think it's like authenticity is kind of like, for example, like you were saying, if you don't get out of bed in the morning all happy, you're going to bring your authentic self to work, like your grouchy authentic self to work. No, do not do that, okay? Don't give yourself a pass on that. But it's really about trust and credibility and also allyship, right? To be an ally. I have your back. You can trust me. I'll do what I say. I will do what I say I will do. And really creating a pattern of, this is a fair workplace and we have some fun here and we have rapport and good connectedness around here. That's not the only thing though. There have to also be expectations and standards and feedback and questioning. People talk about holding accountable, and holding accountable always feels like, what, are you going to fire them if they don't do it? No. But if you notice that people are missing deadlines or not meeting standards, yes, it's important to have a conversation with them because people want to know that you're paying attention. All those elements melded together in an artful way with trial and error based on what people need and what they're responding to, all of those combined with psychological safety.
I think also, that's genius. And I think also going back to what you had said about knowing people's values.
Yes.
I think oftentimes I hear people are searching for the right answers, but you're really talking about asking the right questions.
Definitely. It's really about, you know, the leader, when you talk about authenticity, which I, you know, there's a lot of, you know, unreal talk, pretty unreal talk, right? It's all pretty, but it's not quite right about authenticity. But to your point about questions, that's real. A leader doesn't have to know. A leader has to know what to ask. And it's like the leader, sometimes the leader of the past, like, is supposed to know everything, it's supposed to be hierarchical style. These days, more and more, we're decentralized. We're not hierarchical. We're like working in little squads and little teams. the leader needs to coordinate that like a conductor and ask good questions to help people think for themselves. And that success as a leader for sure.
Is that often when they'll bring you in, Alyssa? I'd imagine this is one of your strength sets as an executive coach is you have seen the questions that can bring out the, you know, the miracles. is that, because I think sometimes when you're so close into this,
yeah,
you can't see the obvious because you've got your own stuff in the way.
Definitely. So I like to catalyze with my clients one thing, curiosity. Like, why did he say that? And people will say, oh, I think he said it because of this. Well, did you ask him? Right? No, I didn't. It's so interesting. You know, why did he say that? Why did he do that? Why did that happen? Where? And then debriefing and doing sort of what we call retrospectives, like thinking about what happened here that got us to this result. And sometimes the result is good. So what happened here that got us to the good result? And how do we keep doing it over and over? And what do we need to improve? Or what happened here that got us to a bad result? And how do we sort of take a look at that? I just had this conversation with one of my clients. It was just like last week. And, you know, this difficult that she was trying to let go and let them run, let her team run with something, because that was one of the guidance that she got from her feedback session. I did 360 feedback for her. And so she was trying to let them run with it. And it kind of didn't go well. So after it didn't go well, we talked through how can she really effectively debrief it with them, because her go-to style is to tell them what went wrong and to tell them what they should do differently. So we talked through the benefit of how do you find a way to ask them the right question, set up the right context, and help them think about what they can do differently by way of process, by way of behavior, being proactive, responsiveness, all those things melding together, that's going to up-level the whole team. People talk about delegation as in just trust them, but don't trust them. You've got to see, can they do it or not? What are you giving them that you know that they can do it? What evidence do you have that they can do it? What guidance and coaching do they need from you when you give them, you know, a new task? And then how do you debrief it with them in hopes of learning? All those things create a learning culture and help people upscale and up-level their game. And all those things create psychological safety when it's coming from the right place.
Let's go back and talk about when the debrief of when things don't go well.
Yes.
Because I see a lot of people go, well, it worked or it didn't. It was a success or a failure. But yes. I often say there's data in the disasters and research.
That's right.
In the rejection.
Data, right. It's very good.
How do you, are there any like high-powered questions or one high-powered question, Alyssa, you could share with the audience? If something didn't go as they had wanted,
yeah,
what would be a great high-powered question to help them mine out the stuff that they may want to take into iteration 2.0?
Excellent question. I'm going to give you the secret question. Is everyone ready for the secret question?
Lean in, people.
Ready? Okay, I'm going to whisper it. The question is, why? Why? And the five whys is, why did that happen? And oh, because of this reason. Well, why did that happen? Because of this reason. Why did that happen? It keeps you going deeper and deeper into what you call the data in the disaster. Really, it's just about being curious about how did we get here? Why did this person do it that way? And what do they need to do differently as a result of that?
You know, you can even think about this with kids.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, if you're going in with a sense of curiosity versus a sense of blame.
Yes.
It changes the entire dynamics.
Absolutely. I mean, and that, again, back to psychological safety. When you're going in with blame, people feel it and they know it and they automatically get defensive. If this is a model, and, you know, the Israeli army kind of perfected this model about coming in with their helmets off. Or like, and their uniforms, you know, sort of no rank in the room. This is not about blame. This is about diagnosing what happened, why did it happen, and how do we change it? And I mean, going back to this example that I was telling you about, I'm thinking about my client who, you know, it's like the consultant that they hired in the conversation kind of went off the rails. Well, why did she go off the rails? Well, she didn't understand the assignment. Why didn't she understand the assignment? Because I guess we didn't brief her correctly. Why didn't you brief her correctly? Well, I guess our briefing documents are kind of 5 years old. Oh,
there's your
right?
answer.
Exactly. I mean, you can keep going and going, but like, so what do we need to do now? I guess we need to really upgrade and update our briefing materials. And we probably also need to have a conversation about how we onboard new consultants. Brilliant. That's fantastic. How are you now going to,
you know, discuss that with your team in a way that you now came to the answer. That's fantastic. How are you going to walk them through a process so they can come up with the answer? Because people want to own something. Of course they do. You want them to own it. If you tell them what to do, it is like endlessly giving them fish. If you ask them questions and have them work it out, and also they might have better ideas, but then you're endlessly teaching them to fish and they can fish without you. So then you can be going to do different things. That's what scale is.
Boom. Okay, we need to. I'm so coming back here, just you and me next week.
Okay,
I mean,
good.
You're a genius.
With it, this, but Petra, yeah. You did ask about motivating yourself.
Yes.
Which I wanted to talk about.
Because actually, let's roll into that.
Okay, go ahead, please.
Karen says, she had written, is it actually possible to create motivated kids, spouses, family members, clients, or is motivation something that is basically intrinsic, bottom line, you know, I've always heard you can't do the carrot and the stick. It's got to be intrinsically driven.
Oh, interesting.
Does it come, do you think we get motivated if we find our own purpose and why?
I really do, our own purpose. And so a family can have a purpose. You know, Stephen Covey talks a lot about the family mission statement. Alan Mulally, the former CEO of Ford, he talks to us about his family meeting every Sunday, where they would talk about sort of the purpose of the family and some of the values of the family. And then they would get into the tasks and the organization of the week. And then, as he says, he hands out allowance at the end, right? So to stay through, you know, that's when the kids were growing up. So the point is that I think that there's a lot of ways through conversation and through, I think, deeper and deeper connection that you can generate purpose in any kind of system, organization, but you have to want to go there. And it can't be, like you said, about blame. It can't be about blame. Like, you should be more motivated. That's not helpful. It's more about unpeeling what turns you on and what makes you motivated. And then how do we fit that into the, I mean, if you're talking about a family, how do we fit it into the context of a family? Now, if you're talking about a company, you can't always fit that into the context of the company. And what that means is this might not be the right fit. Let's talk about that. But in the family, you make the purpose fit the family members because they're family, right? And by the way, that's the difference between companies and families. Mm-hmm. Your family doesn't fire you. In most cases.
I'm going to stay quiet on
yeah,
that
exactly.
One.
Exactly.
Someone had asked here, Liz, actually, a good friend of mine, if you, and because so many people, when I had put this out, you know, we all wish we could have a coach like you in our back pocket. So we're so blessed to have you. If you had one coaching tool,
yeah,
only one that you could keep,
yeah,
what would your go-to coaching tool be?
Only one coaching tool. Wow.
It's not my question.
I know. That's a hard question. There are so many good coaching tools. I'm going to go back to questioning. The best coaching tool is to be able to question. Am I right about that? Yeah, go ahead.
How do you learn? Because again, I keep coming asking, like, we have to ask ourselves, what is my passion? What is my purpose? What is my why? No one teaches us how to ask a good question.
Yeah, open-ended questions. That's right. Some people do come by it naturally. And I think it is a skill to hone and to perfect.
So you just said open-ended questions.
Yes.
Can you clarify that for the listener?
Open-ended questions are ones that cannot be answered by a yes or a no. And so they require more probing and more introspection and more reflection from the other person. And they lead to, a deeper understanding of yourself and of what's going on. And they tend to lead to a deeper connection.
That's so helpful. Just looking at this, there's so many questions here. Someone had asked, and I think this is important, especially in the world that we're living in, you said it's so fast paced. What does self-care mean to you?
Oh,
or
yes.
Can you give a piece of advice for that executive out there, for that mom who's the executive coach,
yes,
you know, for the family? It's so important, yet we wear our tiredness as a badge of honor.
It's so true.
I think that's changing.
That's changing. But it's still true. And it's still in Silicon Valley, it's still true. You know, like, I've hacked sleep. You know, I've been able to live without sleep now. I've solved that problem. By the way, sleep is a very important marker of self-care. So I would say this. I'm going to say it tactically, and then I'm going to say it more abstractly. Tactically, everyone needs to take care of themselves from the point of view of sleep and nutrition and exercise, period. There's just no getting over that. And You know, that means different things for different people, but it does mean getting enough sleep. It means moving your body one way or the other every day. And it means figuring out the nutrition that works for you. Everyone's, you and I have talked about this before. Everyone's got a different, you know, sort of body makeup. You know, from an emotional perspective, I guess I'll be tactical again. It's having some people in your life you can be yourself with and you can vent with and you can really feel safe with. And then it is thinking about what are the things that nourish you. And that's different for everybody. It's reading or it's sports or it's, you know, family time or it's TV or video games. Whatever it is for people, they need to find those couple of things that take them away from their real life. And that's how you create downtime for yourself. And really, you talked about self-care, and that's right. I think of it as nourishment.
I love that. It's nourishing your mind, your heart, your body. And again, you can't ignore one or the other.
Right. They're all linked.
Yeah. I mean, we talk about in the fitness world, mind, body, fitness for years. I'm like, you can't separate them.
I know you really can. You know? And I've learned that. My own fitness journey has taught me that, right? Getting more into my body and more in the experience of understanding that there's a way to rest my brain by going through my body. My coach, my fitness coach, my strength coach, he will tell me, you know, to shake out my body. I'll go, shake it out, you know, the body. And I said to him one time, I need to shake out my mind, really. And he said, shaking out your body does shake out your mind. And I was like, that's brilliant. That's College of Tom. That's like Brilliance of Tom.
No, I love
it. And it's so true. And I find that to be true. And so now, even during the day, I will sometimes shake it out, like with my body. And so you can really see that connection. I think exploring that connection has been a beautiful journey. It's not for everyone, you know, but finding that journey of fitness and that journey of body-mind connection is beautiful.
No, I agree. When I'm writing and if I find like I haven't moved, you know, fitness was such a part of my life before.
Oh, yeah, sure.
I used to get paid to go to the gym.
Right,
and now it's a choice.
Right now.
Which sucks. I know if I'm not moving my body,
right,
Alyssa, my mind will shut down.
It's exactly right.
Yeah.
That's right. You know, and I once heard someone say to Tony Robbins, you know, what if you're just in a state and in a funk, what would you do? Like, has that ever happened to you? He said, of course it's happened to me. I'm human too. And he said, well, what do you do? And Tony Robbins said, the first thing I would do is get up my little
trampoline
and start jumping up and down. That changes the state.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We have to change it up.
It's so true.
Terrell had written in, and I think this is really important because I think so many of us feel like my voice, it doesn't matter. Who am I to make a difference?
Mm-hmm.
Who am I to go for my dreams, to create that vision board? Mm. What would you say about going for it and making a difference in this world? Because I see so many people, Alyssa, that have a vision, have great things to share.
Yeah.
Maybe not from a mountaintop or like on a stage to 10,000 people, but they can make a difference. But they don't because they don't think that one person can make a difference.
Well, didn't Margaret Mead say one person is the only person who has made a difference, right? That one person is the only one who can make a difference. Mm. And I would say, don't worry about your grand schemes. Keep your grand schemes in mind, but step by step, do something. Bias to action. Bias towards action is what saves all of us.
What's the bias to action? I love that. What does that mean, Alyssa?
Well, it's about taking a step. It's about, you know, I mean, it depends sort of what you want to get done. But I know that, you know, certainly there's a lot of political activism around us these days, and you might feel hopeless in any kind of an environment right now. And what can you do that is one step that you can take that will actually drive the conversation forward? Is it communing with people around you? Is it writing to your politicians? Is it joining marches? Or is it also in a social context? Is it about talking to people about recycling? Is it about you doing your own recycling? Is it about you going to a farmer's market and supporting local local produce? And there's all these different ways that you can live your values. But if you think about this also in a professional context, I think middle managers are like so well known for, it doesn't matter what I do, I'm just a cog in the wheel. And if you see yourself as a cog in the wheel, you will never, it's like you can never fully express at work, and work will not get changed at all as a result of your feeling like you're a cog in the wheel. So it's about looking at your sphere of influence and thinking about what is a small thing that I can do within the context of my environment. You know, I'm thinking about, oh, actually one of my startups, they felt that they, you know, they're working really hard. And they felt like they lacked community at some times, and also that they were just working really hard, a little bit all work and no play. And plenty of companies do the sort of the 4 o'clock or the 5 o'clock happy hour, and they just didn't, that wasn't part of their culture. They decided to do a 5-minute workout at 5. And they all come together and they do someone, different person leads it every day, and they do a 5-minute workout together, and it totally shakes things up and it helps them build community, and they have fun and it's laughter and it's just a great experience. How come they decided to do that? One person said, let's do it. And everyone kept building on it. You can make a difference.
Yeah, you've got to be the one.
You've got to be the one.
Going back to that, the middle management, I hear, and we know one of the number one reasons people leave a job or they start looking, lack of appreciation.
Totally.
So for some, that person listening, I'm sure there are many people listening that they say, I just don't feel valued. I just don't feel appreciated. Right. What is one piece of advice that you would give them or have them, one reframe of their mindset when they go back into work tomorrow, that we start to create the change that we, you know, be the change that we want to see in the world?
Yeah. Well, first of all, it is, what change do you actually want to see? And start doing that and being that. And then I would say, always and forever, focus on what you do have and what you have done and what you can do. So gratitude journal in the morning about being thankful for what you've done and what you have. Going into work and seeing the positive, that bucks you up and helps you make one change. And if you identified what that vision is for yourself, you can start doing that. And by the way, if you want to be appreciated, appreciate others.
I so agree. My teacher, Tal Ben-Shahar, I see you have some of his books here.
Yeah.
He said, appreciate the good,
yeah,
and the good will appreciate.
It's so true.
And when you start being a benefit seeker,
yes,
it just, I think you'll start being more, you'll have more luck,
right,
you'll create better relationships,
yes,
you'll be more likable.
Totally, all those things. And to feel like you're a cause in your life. Put yourself in the problem so you can be part of the solution and for you to be the agent, for you to be at cause at what happens, not just that it's happening to you.
I love that. Say that again. When you say put yourself in the problem, what do you mean?
It's
by
like
that?
Realize that you're part of it, right? Mm. So again, with a lightness, all that has to do with a lightness, right? So appreciate what you have and do gratitude and let the person who cut you, or forgive the person who cut you off on the way to work in the morning or whatever, and put yourself into the situation at work with fresh eyes. Like, let's see what I'm doing to contribute to this problem, whatever it is. Maybe it's, what happens a lot in large companies especially is that like this endless process and you can't get anything done because of all the process and it's so bureaucratic and you just throw up your hands like, oh, it will never get anything done. But in fact, if you put yourself in the problem, you can start investigating where are you in this chain of events and how can you think about shortening or lightening up or changing up the systems that you touch? Or how can you call a meeting and talk with people together about the bigger picture? Because very often, by the way, I was at a company, I've been at companies many times where I say, has anyone who touches this process end to end, has everyone, I should say, who touches this process end to end, ever been in the room and talked about the process? And the answer is never. They don't do it. Why not? I don't know. Right? But you could call a meeting of all the people that we're dealing with and people would show up, you know, like have pizza or whatever there. People would show up and you could talk through what do we want to change together.
And I love the two words that you say, curiosity and with a lightness. It's appreciative inquiry.
Yes.
Which is like heavy-handed, you know, questioning.
Definitely. Yes, exactly.
We got so much to touch on and we don't have time. So I'm going to finish with two questions.
Okay.
A good friend of mine, Greg, who is a good coach out of Australia,
yeah,
writes, what is your biggest thinking demon?
Whoa.
And then I'll go on to a lighter. But
I know.
Here's why I think it's really important to ask this question,
yeah,
Alyssa. You are so dynamic. You are so articulate. Everyone's going to go, well, again, she's been doing this for 16 years. And I just always like to bring the humanity back. You know, we all have moments of doubt.
Yeah.
But is there something that you have faced as a coach or that just, you know, you've managed to make peace with and work through, or because we all have them. I know I do.
Yes. So what's funny is that you say that you managed to make peace with. The answer is no, I have not made peace with it. So here it is, right? Yes, I'm super self-critical, like a lot of people you know, Ms. Perfection Detox, right? So I'm super self-critical. And to be honest with you, I tend to run high on anxiety. Hmm. And so it's not like I don't, you know, I'm not in that place where I would say, you know, I have to be medicated for my anxiety, but I have to be constantly mindful of that I run high on anxiety and I'm self-critical. So all those things come together. And when you say that I've resolved or made peace with it, no, I make peace with it every day and I move forward and it gets easier. So for example, I didn't really do a lot of writing for years because I was so I think, paralyzed with self-criticism. And so now it's still there, but I'm able to move through it. And I get a lot of writing done now, which is a miracle and a blessing. And I'm so thankful for that. But I'm still doing it in the face of having to put aside my critical voices all the time and feeling anxious all the time.
Yeah, I think that, like I have to say, you know, it doesn't go away.
It doesn't go away.
But you recognize it sooner.
Definitely. And you have more tools to deal with it. So I have my self-talk is a lot more higher level. And my self-talk, well, you know, sometimes I'll self-talk like I'm talking to a child, like, it's okay. It's okay. I find that very soothing. It's okay. And also, I'm just identifying. It used to be this sort of just gray morass. Now I'm identifying what's going on with me, and I can use my self-talk to counteract those voices and that experience. And I would encourage everyone to upgrade their self-talk. You asked before about one coaching tool. One life tool to help everybody is to upgrade what you tell yourself.
Amen. I don't know where to end. I mean, we need a part two on this, but I think if for the person listening, and they're like, we're going to have in the show notes, we're going to, at the end of the show, find out where we can find more of Alyssa. If you were to say that one person right now, and they're listening going, oh my God, I just wish, you know, I could feel this motivated tomorrow without listening to a podcast.
Yeah.
Is there something, you had said this, like the miracles are often the people that can keep going.
Yeah.
Is there something that you could share to that listener? Or maybe like a little nugget for the moment when they're not sure if they can wait for the miracle? A little bit of like what you can help them stay buoyant in the unknowing times.
Yeah, I mean, there's, first of all, I just want to say again, having your tribe, your advisory board around you helps you have a lifeline when you need it to remind you of your greatness. So the answer is, what does it take to surround yourself with people, things, ideas, and strategies that help remind you of your greatness? So write down compliments you get and put them in a little compliment jar. Save the emails you get, which are great, in an inspiration folder. Have friends to call. Do your gratitude journal every day, every morning, and upgrade your self-talk. Tell yourself you can do it, or one step at a time, or be very tactical. Because, you know, sometimes we wait to start something until we're motivated. Start something and you will get motivated. So that's, again, bias to action.
Alyssa, where can we find more of you? I'm just like, my brain is spinning right now. Like, I have a book. She's got a book. Forget writing for magazines. There's a book here. Where can the listeners find more of you? Where can they get in touch with you?
Well, they can get in touch with me on Twitter at Alyssa Cohn, AlyssaCohn. No E's in my names, either of them, Alyssa Cohn. And of course, my website, AlyssaCohn.com.
We'll have both of those in the show notes at the end. Thank you so much for the gift of your time, your nuggets of wisdom, and also for your friendship.
Thank you, Petra, and likewise, thank you for having me and very much for your friendship.
Thank you so much for the gift of your time. I hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, would you be so kind as to pop on over to iTunes and leave a written review? This is the way we get to spread this show and these conversations with those who may need a little motivation and inspiration on this journey called life. So until next time, may you find that the world is smaller than you thought, kinder than you knew, and always on your side.